Hack the Entrepreneur is part of Rainmaker FM, the digital business podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm. Have you been scared, shaking, and hesitating on the edge of starting your own business? It's time to jump in. It's time to find your maniacs, and I have created 1,000 Maniacs specifically for you. I will show you exactly how I went from 0 to 1,000 email subscribers and turned them into maniacs. Then I will show you exactly how to create and sell your first product with the Tiny Product System. 1,000 Maniacs will teach you everything you need to know about setting up an email list, autoresponders, what to send and when, developing a relationship with your list, and how to create what your maniacs want and then sell it to them. Claim your free roadmap right now. Go to 1000maniacs.com and get on the list to get priority access to the next live webinar. That's 1000maniacs.com. Your maniacs are waiting.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. Today's conversation is a little bit different. It's longer than usual, and we had a real technical glitch somewhere around the 2/3 to 3/4 mark. We had to pick up the call again, so there's a slight change in sound, but I think we did a pretty good job for you. And this is a really, really cool conversation that I know you are really going to enjoy. I'm your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is a 20-plus year veteran of the music industry. As a musician, he published dozens of albums and has sold millions of copies. In 2006, he decided to move into the business side of the music industry as co-founder and president of Noisetrade, a revolutionary tribe-building platform. Noisetrade began as a way for my guest to promote his own music, but due to its success, he found himself helping friends and friends of friends do the same thing. Demand was so great, he needed to build this platform. Noisetrade was recently acquired by Pledge Music in a deal that is set to propel Noisetrade forward and enable them to help more and more artists build their tribes. Now, let's hack Derek Webb. I have a confession to make. I'm a bit of an email nerd. So I subscribe to a ton of email newsletters and people's websites and blogs and just their email lists to see what they do in their marketing. And I'm shocked with how many people send just untargeted or impersonal email messages. It's been proven that companies using marketing automation see 53% higher conversions than those using traditional email marketing. You need to treat your contacts and your customers as unique individuals, rather than just sending them the same message. You should see today why thousands are upgrading to a more intelligent marketing solution. And today you can sign up for a free 14-day trial right now, no credit card needed. Visit activecampaign.com. That's activecampaign.com/hack. There's no training fees, there's no contracts, and pricing is accessible for any size of business. Start marketing smarter today. Get and convert more leads with ActiveCampaign at activecampaign.com/hack for your 14-day free trial. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest. Derek, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Absolutely my pleasure. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled to get to talk to you.
Very cool. All right, Derek, so you are a man who has worn and wears many hats, but we are talking to entrepreneur Derek today.
Right.
And I would just like to know, Derek, as an entrepreneur, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
I think the answer will be ironic, but it's like, I think failure is easily the thing that has lended most to whatever successes I've had. Like, you know, I'm certainly wired for perfectionism, but in as far as I've managed to try and fail at things and then, you know, learn and adapt and try again, I mean, like, that's been, in my opinion, the best thing I've had going for me is, you know, that I've had some safe space to fail. And, you know, and I've made my living for 20 something years as a musician, as an artist, and have had the opportunity, for instance, to kind of try some things and to kind of throw myself on the gears with a few ideas. And that's how Noise Trade, you know, started, which is the company that I run now. And, you know, and if I hadn't had the opportunity to try at that and fail a little bit at it and learn some things, then, you know, I don't think we would have kind of figured it out. And so anyway, I mean, I think I've always said, I think that failing is easily the most important thing you're doing all the time. I mean, you don't learn much from successes. You typically, maybe you take a minute to celebrate, but then you blow right past and you move on. But when you fail, you really pay attention for a second. And if you're smart and if you can be tenacious, then you can learn things and then you can go at it smarter the next time. And I think that's easily been the greatest contributing factor to whatever success I've had has been my failures.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. So, and I fully agree with you, but it's also, I think, like, as humans, I mean, it's one of our biggest struggles, right? Is that making that mistake and then sort of getting like sideswiped by it and you can't even continue on, or else then it's like you choose a completely different path. So this ability to kind of use it as a learning tool, as an education and something to propel you forward, is this something that's kind of innate within you, Derek? Or did you adopt this at some point?
Right. I mean, I think it's probably really helped that I've made a living as an artist for so long, because you don't, at least during the era, so I'm like 41, you know, I started playing music, like I started my first band that I would really call like a career in the early 90s. And half of our band's career was pre-internet. So you really had to, like, there was no blue collar trajectory. You were either a professional and up in the head of the sales curve, which was really hard to get into, or you were a hobbyist and there just was nothing in between. And now our market's completely different now. It's the head of the sales curve has fallen over sideways, and now the whole market is the middle class, and the head of the sales curve is the anomaly. But at the time, you had to be really tenacious, and you had to really fight, and you had to, and my advice used to be to people when they would ask me, you know, like what advice I could give if they were looking to make a living as an independent musician or artist or whatever, and what advice could I give? I would typically tell people, I would ask people if there's anything else they could imagine themselves doing. And if there's anything else they're good at, and if there is, you should probably go do that, because it's going to get really hard and it's going to get impossible. And the only way you're going to survive it is if you really just, like, for me, I just have so few, I have such narrow skills. I'm just not good at very many things. So the few things I'm good at, I've fought to spend my time doing. And I remember being in high school when I was in bands and trying to make that work and thinking to myself, like, I'm either going to wind up in a band or working in a music store. But like, this is all I do. This is all I can do. I'm not good at anything else. And I knew from really early on that I just had to figure out a way to make it work. I had to figure out a way to fight through and make something of it. And I think something about that ethic has just bled through to where now, you know, I'm kind of hardwired. But here's the other thing is the great truth of, and I know we're talking more about the entrepreneurial side, but as I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, being an independent musician is entrepreneurial work. If you are always at least a small business owner, it's always more than that, but it's never not that. And not to de-romanticize it or anything, but I think that, you know, approaching it that way, you know, I feel like that's been a great benefit to me. And, you know, I think that's how I got that way, though, is the point, is that I've had to kind of fight my way through. And being a blue-collar musician in today's market, the hard truth of it is that you're just not owed a career. Like, just because you're really talented, I have much more talented friends than me at everything I do on the music side. Better songwriters, better singers, better performers, better producers. And so the reason that I've managed to make a living at it for so long is not because I'm more talented than my friends by a long shot. It's because I'm more tenacious. And you know what I'm saying? And so it's like, because the great dirty secret is you're just not owed a career. Like, if you like, if you're not willing to work hard and adapt and use every part of the buffalo and really learn how to, if you're not willing, if you don't put that kind of work into it, it's a blue collar job. I mean, being an independent musician is a blue collar job. It's not fame and fortune. If you're looking for fame and fortune, you just need to get into another line of work. But if you love it and it's really what you want to do and you feel like it's either that or bust, well, the good news is there is a great blue collar living to be made, and really no one can stop you. There's no barrier to the market for you anymore, but you have to be willing to work. But you really do. It is work, and you have to work at it, because you're just not owed a career.
Yeah. So you said some really, really key things here. And I love this idea of how it's blue-collar work being a musician, an independent musician.
Yeah.
I mean, a working musician of any sort that makes their living and isn't Mick Jagger or isn't...
That's right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's... Yeah. That's
which our market is no longer set up to produce anymore. Like, we are in the post rock star era. Like, the market just doesn't produce them. Like, we're seeing the last class of real rock stars. I mean, with Prince having passed just some days ago, I mean, like, we're literally seeing the last. I mean, you know, it's like we had Prince, we've got The Boss, we've got The Stones, we've got U2, we've got McCartney, we've got Petty, this is the last class of them. And beyond this, we have rock stars in niches, but we're just not, the market is not equipped or set up. It's not even the intention of the market anymore to produce like ubiquitous global rock stars and pop stars. So,
and I love it. I love this.
I do too.
I love the Jason Isbells, the Frank Turners.
That's exactly right.
The Derek Webbs. It's like, well, it's true. I love that this is how music has gone.
Yeah.
Where it's not dictated by somebody somewhere else. It's dictated by what we like as consumers and listeners.
Right. It's 1,000 niches and everyone has access to it. So there's literally an audience for everyone. So the trick used to be, how do we break into the market? How do we actually get access to distribution, promotion, marketing? How do we get access to those things? Because the gatekeepers kept all that, and the only access you could have to the market was to get signed, and it was a long vetting process and the odds were stacked against you. Now everyone has access to the market. Everyone can both fund, record, produce, distribute, and promote art now. Everybody can. So now the challenge is not scarcity, it's anonymity. You know, it's like it's falling through every crack in the noise of the market and not being found. But the good news is there is an audience for everyone, even if it's a really small audience. But because of the tools we have in the market today, you can make a great living with fewer. Like it's a tribe building business. It's like it's what Kevin Kelly wrote in his essay, I don't know, like a decade ago. Yeah. One of the most prophetic things I've ever read in my life, and I reread it probably 4 times a year. The 1,000 true fans. If you can find those 1,000 true fans, if you can find 1,000 people who will give you $100 a year between albums, concerts, online engaging, merchandise, whatever, you've got a career for the rest of your life. You've got a blue collar career for the rest of your life. And so you can make a great robust living on a smaller audience than ever before. It used to take 1 million people buying your record, you know, to even have a voice in the market. Now that's the anomaly. And it's a market of 1,000 niches. And it's like, and I do love it. I love the market as it is. There are things we gave up, but I prefer it this way.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, we don't have a choice anyway. So it really doesn't matter what we think about it.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. The dinosaur can complain that his neck's not tall enough to reach the leaves on the tall tree until the day he's packed in ice, or he can adapt and grow a longer neck. So it's like,
exactly.
you're totally right about that.
Yeah. And so it's I love the 1,000 true fans, and it's absolutely true. And I don't know, it's such a different thing. But then also your idea of how when you started out as a musician, your back was against the wall.
Yeah.
Like that's literally how you went at it. And then that blue collar sort of living, making a blue collar living as an independent musician, this is entrepreneurship.
That's right.
Because entrepreneurship is the same thing. I mean, the 1,000 true fans is based around business almost, more around than
100%.
Art.
Yep.
And it's not the big monoliths that have to like let you now publish an article maybe in their newspaper to get heard, or
that's
be
right.
on their television station,
yeah.
or be on their radio show. This is coming at you from like my home office.
That's exactly
I've reached millions of people from my home office.
Yeah, like you are disrupting that side of it. And that's exactly what the era we're in has made possible, you know.
But that idea of putting your, of admitting that your back is against the wall, that you have no other options.
That's right.
Lots of us feel that way, but we decide, because I mean, obviously there, Walmart existed. You could have had an option of stocking shelves, but that's not really an option.
Right.
Right. But some people decide somehow that that is their only other options. Like,
that's
I'll
right.
never make it as an artist. I'll never make it as a podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to do the, and it's not really a plan B. That's
right.
That's like a plan Z.
That's right. That's right.
But if you approach it with the idea that it's a lot of hard work and it's blue collar and it's, you're going to have to struggle and push and push and push, but
yeah.
it will work. I love that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and that's been, you know, and that's what I felt transitioning from my independent solo career as a musician to running Noise Trade. To me, I felt like as an independent artist, I've never had hardly any commercial ambition. Like, I've really enjoyed selling exactly the amount of records I need in order to make my living at it, but generally stay off the commercial radar. And because I've seen too many of my friends who have really robust, big careers, semi-famous to full-on famous people, who are kind of miserable because they've inadvertently gotten into the platform building business, which is a business you never get out of. And suddenly, you know, and once you get into the business of building and securing your platform, you hardly ever get on it to say anything again. But I've managed to keep mine so low to the ground that I actually get pretty good sleep at night in terms of the art that I make and when I make it, what I get to make it about. And, you know, I've decided early on that I wanted to find that threshold of like exactly what I needed to do to survive. And then I wanted to sabotage beyond it to keep it at about that size. But I had the luxury of being in a band for 10 years before my solo career that sold millions of records. And so I did get a taste of that. And so I know it's a luxury for me because my friends who even might agree with my ethic on that, it's still way too tempting. They're like, yeah, but I'd love to just know what that feels like. And I'd love, which I get. And I had the luxury of seeing and feeling it for a few years. And now I'm like, if I sold 500,000 records next year, my career would be over. I'd be miserable. I love just selling, you know, just what I need in order to not be famous, to make really good money, and to be in complete control. Like that is the best version of success. That's what I would wish on anybody. But it's like, it's counterintuitive. Like, it's not why most people get into it.
Right.
And so that's where Kevin Kelly's insights come in really handy, because it's like this great creative algorithm to tell you, like, if your ego can bear not being a household name, and if you can bear never making seven figures a year in your life, there is a great, fulfilling, robust blue collar living to be made as a creative type. And that's such good news, but not for most people who get into music, you know, to be rich and famous. I mean, there was the whole old model, that was the whole draw. You come in, you get signed, and your life changes overnight. The new model is your life never really changes. So,
well, except that you are like literally making your living.
Yes.
On your
art and
work.
But you know, you still walk out and get your mail the same way, and you still go to the post office the same way, and you still, you know, you don't, you know, I mean, because I can go to any coffee shop in Nashville, and literally not one person knows who I am. But I've made a living at this for 20 years. I mean, I get to put records out when I want about what I want. I mean, there isn't a more fulfilling version of a career that I could imagine, but I still complain about it because, you know what I mean? Because like because even I, with the luxurious experience that I've had, still also feel that there are moments where you're like, oh man, like I know I've done this for 20 years. I know what the compromises are. I know how to sell more records. Maybe I should just, you know, wouldn't things be easier if I could just sell this many thousand more? It would relieve pressures in these areas. But it's like, no, that I wouldn't be happier. Like, because then that would just tip the first domino over into me winding up like my friends who have huge careers and are miserable because they got famous doing things that they really don't like. And so you either get to have, other than the few exceptions that are very incredibly special, that are really the anomalies in the middle class market, you either get to make a lot of compromises and get famous and be miserable because you're doing things you hate, or you get to struggle and make things you think are really important. And there's kind, I mean, this is a market, this is a business of extremes. So, you know, like there isn't really a lot in between. Like you're going to err on one side or the other. And I spent a few years erring on the one side. So I'm going to spend the rest of my career erring on the other.
Nice. I like it. And okay, so there seems to be this time looking back, Derek, in every entrepreneur's life when they realize one of two things, that either they have this calling to start making things that like change the world in some way, or they find that they can't work for somebody else. And so they need to push a business in that direction.
Yes.
You were about a year ago, year and a half ago, you were on a good friend of mine, Adam Clark's The Gently Mad.
Yes.
And great, great conversation that everybody should check out. I will link to it for you. But you said, I love the idea, honestly, of 20 years in the music business now being a footnote to a new season of entrepreneurial work for me. So this seems like, looking back, like this is your time where, and I fully agree that musician and creating things and being a solo and starting your own, it's your own small business. That is entrepreneurship. But mm-hmm. now you've really, truly started an actual business away from your career.
Yes.
And I would love to know what made you decide to take this and try and push your 20 years as an artist to a footnote in your new entrepreneurship.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what I had hoped to accomplish, which to me was really just kind of shoring up some ambition. I was like, you know, I want my, you know, 20 years as a musician to literally be, you know, the footnote. That's exactly right. And honestly, like yet again, it came from like, this has been a very organic process because, you know, I don't think I ever set out to be an entrepreneur. I don't think I ever set out to start a business. I never set out to do. It's just been adapting as I go and learning as I go. And, you know, when I first started my solo career, I didn't really know a lot about how to run my own business. I'd spent 10 years in a band that really I feel like was one of the last bands to sneak through the old model because we got signed in the early 90s. And so it was like big budgets and it was a really small market. And so, you know, and that's what I was used to. And, you know, touring in buses and, you know, is like but by the time I started my solo career, everything was changing and had changed. And I got into, so I will just as the blueprint or the kind of trajectory of how I got here, you know, when I signed my first solo deal, I signed it with a guy named Jeff Mosley, who had a record label called INO Records, which has since changed its name to Fair Trade. And Jeff had this really great progressive business model for his label because he'd been in the label world for a long time and had seen artists get really screwed and lose their publishing, lose their recorded masters and just have nothing and have to just killing themselves on the road to make no money. And he didn't think that was fair. So he started a record label. And this was very progressive for like the early 2000s. This was before 360 deals and all these crazy disruptive models came in. He had this amazing deal where you come in. He only really worked with artists who he felt like were really hard workers and either had or had kind of followings or had some tribes that they already had cultivated. And those were the kind of artists he was signing. And I was coming off of a band that had a pretty good 10-year run. So he felt like I was a decent fit for that. And his model was you come in, you make the record, you pay for it completely, and you bring it in finished, mixed, mastered. He'll put it out. We mutually agree on how we're going to spend the marketing money. We spend that money, we recoup that money back to him, and then we split everything 50-50. And artist keeps the publishing, recorded masters revert back after however many years, 7 or 8 years. And it was this crazy generous, because he knew he could be extremely generous and also make a great living for himself. And so that was, but the reason I bring all that up is because like my first record coming off of the old record deal, like this is what taught me how to transition. This was my education because, you know, my first record, I think I spent, you know, 30 grand to make it of my own money because that was the record deal. And then that was, you know, a fraction of what my previous band had ever spent making a record. We had 6-figure budgets. You know what I'm saying? But this was the, you know, this is the early 90s.
Yeah.
But so in the early 2000s, so I'm, you know, I managed to spend like, I think 30 grand on my first record. Then I was like, okay, I can never do that again because, and I'm controlling this part of the cost. So I need to learn how to make records for cheaper. Like I just have to learn how to do it if I'm going to make a living. So, and I'd never fancied myself as an engineer, like, or a producer or anything. I've always leaned on other people to do that stuff. But I was like, well, but that's where I'm spending all my money. And I'm paying musicians and I'm paying. So I need to learn how to play more instruments. I need to learn how to put mics on stuff. I need to learn how to use Pro Tools. I need to learn how to. So my second record, I spent half the money on that stuff. And the other half, I spent about the same amount, maybe a little less, but half of it I spent investing into gear that I was determined to learn how to use. I bought some preamps. I bought some microphones. And by my second or third record, I was doing partial recording in studios and partial home recording on Pro Tools, doing overdubs and stuff. And fast forward to now, I now play all the instruments. I record all the stuff. I have my own home studio. I can basically make records for $0 now,
wow.
Literally for $0. And every record I've made from my first, I spent less and less and less. My last record came out 2 years ago. I think I spent maybe $5,000 making it. And it sounds $50,000 better than my first record. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that is what taught me. Like that was my education. Like where are you spending money and how you can control those costs. It's the basics of running a small business. And then that's really how I backed into Noise Trade, which was after my third record, which was a record called Mockingbird, my tribe had bought it. You know, like at that point, me and Jeff had figured out what the size of my little market. And so we budgeted to break even selling about 20 or 25,000 records. That was about the size of my little market. And didn't matter how much marketing money we spent, you know, we would sell that amount of records. And so we learned how to not spend too much marketing money. We learned how to make money. And even though he had much bigger artists selling way more records, I think he probably, all told, made more money on me because those bands cost so much money to run, you know? And so we'd figured that out. My tribe had bought my third record, and there was no more marketing money 6 months into the record cycle and sales were trickling. It was over. You know, that record's life was over. That initial big splash was over. And if you've heard the story before, I apologize, but it kind of demonstrates the point that, you know, I went to them and said, you know, they started to talk to me about, you know, it's time to start thinking about the next record now because this record is done because we have no more money where it's not selling anymore and your tribe has it. So let's move on. And I said, you know, I think, and normally I'd be super happy and say, great, let's move on. But this particular record had themes and ideas on it that I thought would be resonant with people who I knew hadn't heard it. And so that our marketing dollars couldn't find. And I asked them if we could keep working on it. And they said rhetorically, I think to me, unless you can come up with a way to promote the record that won't cost us any money, we have to move on. So I said, okay, well, hold on. Like, let me think about that. Went back to them. Sony Columbia was my parent label at the time. I went back to them and said, would you let me for 3 months, let me give away the record for free online for email addresses and postal codes for geo-targeted email? Because this was 2006. Even in 2006, my manager and I had the wherewithal to know that data would be so valuable because if we could give away a bunch of records, the people who downloaded it for free and hated it and deleted it was a zero opportunity cost for us. We never would have gotten their money. So we're not giving anything up there. But the people who had not found it over three records at that point in my career had never found me, didn't know about me, had not taken a chance on me, who downloaded it, loved it. If you download the record and you love it and I've got your information, I will get your money. Like, I will, you know what I'm saying? And it's not even a trick. It's like, because you can't wait to give it to me. Because if you really love and resonate with what I'm making, you're going to want to support it. Because I'm that way with artists who I love. And that was our thought. We went to Sony. And here's again, where the answer to your first question about my greatest, you know, failure being my greatest asset. They had never heard of me. I mean, I'm on their label. They're like, who's this guy? He's on our roster. We've never heard him. Let him do whatever he wants. Because I wasn't very big. I was like, I hardly sold any records to them. So they let me do it. I gave away that record for 3 months for emails and postal codes. And in 3 months' time, I gave away 85,000 records digitally. And so suddenly I was sitting on a giant customer database of people who loved me because at that time, piracy was at an all-time peak. You know, little kids and grandmothers getting sued by, you know, and chased by the FBI for pirating. Mm-hmm. And here I am, the copyright owner. I can give it to you for free. So these people had my record. You could buy it for $10 on iTunes. It was my new record. I gave it to them for free. They'd never given me a dime. And so suddenly I had a very fertile customer database to go to and engage and immediately learn some really, yes, that worked, but where Noise Trade was born was where we started to really look at the data and we learned that we could make that make money for us, which basically just took saying, where are these people? Like, and I discovered that in the five cities where I'd given away the most records, two of them I had never played a show in as a solo artist. It was New York and LA. Never in my 4 years at that point had I played a show in either city, because those were really competitive markets. And I'm like a niche folk singer. You know, I don't have any business going to those cities. But here's this data that says I've got a ton of fans. So I called my agent and I said, I want you to get me any show for any pay in any venue on any night in Los Angeles. I'll take anything. And they got me a Wednesday night, which is horrible, at the Knitting Factory on Hollywood Boulevard for zero guarantee, but 90% of the door. So it's all risk on me, right? And there are three rooms in the Knitting Factory. There's the downstairs bar, which is not even a venue. There's a PA down there, but it's like the overflow bar. It holds 100 people. There's the mid-size, which is about 500. And then there's the upstairs room, which is like thousands. That's where big artists would play. And they gave me the downstairs bar on a Wednesday night. They're like, the bartender was going to be down there anyway. We never have music on a Wednesday, so feel free. Come on out and do it. It won't cost us a penny. It's all on you. So I took it. And 2 weeks before the show, we segmented that list to just the people within 20 miles of downtown LA where the venue was. And as I recall, it was about 2,200 people. Because again, 85,000 records, this was in the top five cities. So it's a lot of people. So 2,200 people. I sent them an email saying, hey, I'm coming. Thank you so much for downloading the record. I hope you love it. I'm coming to LA. 10 bucks at the door. Please come out. 2 days before the show, we hit them again. Hey, just a reminder. Hope you love the record. Please come out. No idea what was going to happen. So I showed up in LA to play the show, did the sound check, walking around, you know, to get food. I'm coming back with my buddy. We're walking down Hollywood Boulevard and we're coming up to the venue. And, you know, again, the big room at Knitting Factory, that, you know, huge artists play there. And so we're walking up and there's this line down Hollywood Boulevard to get in the Knitting Factory. And my buddy and I are saying to each other, I wonder who's playing the big room. Maybe we can sneak into that show when I'm done playing my show downstairs. And we walk up and literally as I'm approaching the front of the venue, like everybody starts breaking into applause. And I'm like, what's happening right now? Like who, what? And it turned out they were all there lined up down the street to get into my show. And the Knitting Factory's looking at me like, who the hell are you? You know, are you famous? And I was like, no, that's why this is insane and crazy. It's amazing that we pulled this off. And it's not, this was not a strike of lightning. Like this isn't some random luck. This was, we did this on purpose with data. And so we sold the show out with 100 people, turned away 200 at the door, which I actually went out on the sidewalk and played a second show after the show was over to the 200 people that didn't get in. They booked me that night to come back 6 months later for a guarantee in the next bigger room, which I did and sold it out 6 months later. We did the same thing at the Bitter End in New York, sold it out, turned away the capacity of the room. Who the hell are you? I mean, exactly the same thing. Wow. And so at that point, I'm thinking, okay, like I'm so tired of going to random cities and playing for 10 people and not knowing why no one showed up, and then going to other cities and playing for 500 people and not knowing why they showed up, depending on promoters who don't promote anymore, you know? And so suddenly I thought, oh, well, no, we just demystified it. I just need to own the relationships with my tribe. I need to own the data so I can dig tunnels under promoters, under iTunes, under everybody, go directly to these fans, know where they are, know how to get in touch with them, have permission to do that. And it changed my career. It changed my career overnight. And that's when Noise Trade was born. And it took us 2 years to bring it to market. But I just wanted my friends to be able to do what I had done. In 2006, I knew they wouldn't think of it. So in 2008, we launched it, you know, because I knew I had so many artist friends who were at my level who I knew would be more than willing to give away a little bit of content in exchange for data with which they can make a living. I knew they would. And that's where it started. And so I backed into starting that business. We just happened to solve a problem for me that wound up being a transcendent solution more so than my use for it. And I think that's what great entrepreneurs do. You identify problems and you find problems and identify solutions. And I didn't even know what an entrepreneurial idea that was or entrepreneurial moment that was for me, that I had identified a problem in the market. I had actually backed into a great solution. And that was the birth of my entrepreneurial career. And I had no idea.
Yeah.
You know,
it's so interesting. Like how you say you even back into it. So you decide to give out your record for free, which was unheard of at the time because of the peak of pirating at that point. And you didn't seem to have, as we would call in business, like a back end sort of monetization plan at the time. Like you didn't have a way that you thought you were going to make money, but then all of a sudden you got 85,000 people with geo-targeting and then you realize, oh, New York and LA.
Right.
So then you realize that, wow, other people could also do this. So what's the step that you went through? Like, okay, this is a great idea and this could help a lot of people, but I have no idea how to create like a marketplace online or software, or you know what I mean? Like, how did you do it? Like, did you decide at that point to find co-founders, or was this just telling as many people and seeing if you could get someone to help you or work with you?
So when we ran our little experiment, giving that record away, we really didn't know for sure if it would work. We didn't even know what success would mean. We just had an instinct that it was the right way to go. We thought that was the cost of finding out was so low. And so we really wanted to, and little did we know that it was going to have the effect that it did. Little did we know that it was going to wind up having the effect on my career that it did, and that we were going to discover the things we discovered. But interestingly, in the 2 years between 2006 and 2008, when we were trying to bring it to market and trying to figure that out, we did approach a handful of investors and people like that, and tried to get some support for the idea, tried to get some folks to give us a little bit of money to help us get it off the ground. And nobody would, because there, as you said, there just was no kind of revenue model around it. It wasn't a business model yet. It was just a solution and addressing a specific problem. So, and not to have delusions of grandeur, but you might recall, you know, that like that, you know, you think of the way that Facebook started, where for a long time they had no idea how they would make it make any money. They just knew that it was working. They just knew that people were responding, that it was solving a specific problem. And we were just kind of stupid enough to not let that deter us. Like, you know, we would pitch the idea and people would be blown away. We'd tell them the whole story that I just told you. And they would be like, yeah, that's all incredible. And that sounds amazing. And I think you're right. I think it's going to work. You know, that all seems like it's going to work. And then they would say, well, right, but what's the business model? Like, how are you going to make it make any money? And we were like, well, we don't know. I mean, you know, because my thing was like, I'm going to keep using it. So I'm going to benefit financially in my career, because I'm going to use this model for the rest of my life. But no one would give us any money. And for a long time, there was no business model. And honestly, for the first few years, there kind of wasn't a business model. We built it, like me and I found three co-founders. We each put in a little tiny bit of cash just to kind of get the first version of the site up and running, which was the most basic thing, but it worked. It really worked. And it did exactly what I had done. It just allowed artists to upload content, and then our little widget at the time would essentially just run the transaction of getting the email and the postal code for the content, and work the download, verify the email. It worked really well. It was really simple. But we built it to kind of be automated. It was touchless. Like, no one had to run it. So no one was running the company for the first few years. It just kind of sat there. We would all go online every few months and go to noisetrade.com, make sure it was still online, you know, like we, you know, and so it wasn't a business for a while. It was just an idea, and it was working, but we had to bootstrap it. And I'm so glad we did, because over time we went through some adaptation and some iteration, and we figured out kind of what it was. And we figured out, oh, people want to come here and discover music, because it was an artist services platform essentially at the beginning, where we never imagined anyone but artists coming to noisetrade.com and doing, you know, uploading content and generating code that they could embed other places to put these little widgets that would run the transaction. That's what we thought was going to happen. But we had them running on the front page, where you could go through and see which artists were doing it. And so once a few bigger artists started doing it, then their fans would see the little powered by Noisetrade. They're like, well, what's Noisetrade? So the fans would wind up on our site, and we realized, oh, wait, we've got a secondary market. We thought our market was artists, musicians, labels, managers. But it turns out we've got a secondary market of all of those, of our clients' fans. Our clients' market is also our market. But the site was horrible. It had no search field. People would write into support saying, hey, you guys' website sucks, because I can't find anything. There's no search. And we're like, well, why? Who are you? Why would you be on my website? You know, why would you be here searching for anything? This is an artist services website. And we're like, well, but this is what the market's telling us. Like, people want to use Noisetrade to discover music. So we need to adapt. So we tooled it and remade it as more of a discovery platform. And suddenly we were doing both. And here we are, you know, almost 8 years later. And when we started the site, we had a dozen records on the site, and now we've got, I don't know how many albums, but we've got, you know, 35,000 or so artists, a few thousand authors, because Noisetrade Books launched a few years ago. You know, we've got, you know, and we give away, you know, around a quarter of a million full albums a month. And we have, you know, 1.5 million people on an email list who we feature music 2-3 times a week. And we, And we have made a business out of it, and we have been able to run it like the kids in the candy store, because we're all artists. We're all, you know, it's my same co-founders, and we still run it the same way. Now we just recently gotten acquired, and we're going with that. You know, we're continuing to work on it and work with it, but it's like, it's a pretty crazy story, but it should be an encouragement to entrepreneurs because I know there's so much pressure to like have that business model and all that stuff all worked out at the beginning. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try to do that, but sometimes you just back into a solution that you know is going to work. And sometimes you have to let it show itself for what it is and show its value for a long time before you realize what the business model is and how it can make any money.
Were you guys ever at any point, though, not open to the idea of consumers coming to your site? And like, I like how you kept thinking, it's like, well, that's not our market. It's just artists.
Right.
And this whole big thing opened up, but some people would be resistant to that and be like, no, you're not for us.
Yeah.
Like, just stay away. We're not going to go in that direction.
Well, I think there was a minute where we were like, no, like we need to focus here. Like, yeah, I know that people wanted to use it this way, but that's not what we do. This is what we do. But I think it was like, we were trying to figure it out, and we were trying to figure out how it was going to work and how we could make it self-sustain. I mean, that's all we really cared about, was how to keep it running to where we could break even, and it would just run, and our friends could use it, and I could use it, and we could provide it as a platform for people to use. But I think there was a point at which what we learned was, it's like there's two ways to sell a newspaper. You can either have a small readership, all of whom pay for the newspaper, and that's how you pay for it, or you can give away the newspaper for free, have a giant readership, and then leverage the attention of your readership to advertisers and things like that, and sponsors, and get other people to pay essentially for the newspaper. And you might make about the same money, but you can distribute a lot more newspapers the other way. So it's like, and those are both good models, and there are businesses built on both. And we pivoted at one point, because early on, in order to pay for it, we were charging artists a little sign-up fee, and that's how we were kind of breaking even. And then we determined, you know, we're just not growing fast enough. Like, we can't get enough artists to sign up if we're charging them money. And we're asking them to give away something for free in order to get data to leverage into a bigger career. We need to be eating our own dog food, so to speak. Like, we need to lean into that model ourselves as a company, and we need to give this whole thing away for free and then monetize it a different way. So rather than charging for every newspaper, we need to give the newspaper away for free and then monetize the attention, which is what we did. And so when we opened it up, which happened very early on, but when we opened it up and took the price tag off, well, then we had artists signing up like crazy, and we grew that side of it. At the same time, we were observing the way people were using it, the questions they were sending into support. Why aren't you guys helping us discover artists? And we were smart enough early on. Now, this is not me. This was our lawyer and my co-founders. And they said, you know, like, what you should really be doing, you should build into your terms and conditions that Noisetrade also gets to capture those emails and postal codes. Whoa. Even if we never do anything with it, we should be capturing those too. We should make sure that we're allowed to have those and communicate with people. And so we had been doing that. And all of a sudden, one of my co-founders, who was kind of keeping an eye on things for us, he sent us an email. And this probably would have been like year three, year four, I don't know. And he said, hey, you guys, like, did you guys realize we have like 150,000 people on an email list? Does anybody know that? Like, should we email them? And it was like, and because at the time, like, I think we'd maybe turned advertise, like, you know, we'd gotten some Google ads going, and, you know, we were making a little money, and it was going great, you know, and so we were like, yeah, let's email all these people. And so all of a sudden we were like, all right, well, what's on the site that we think is cool? And let's tell them about it. So we started doing like staff picks and stuff like that. And then we started getting crazy amounts of emails. Like, how do I get in that? I saw you guys send an email out. How do I get in there? And suddenly we're like, all right, well, if we curate this and we only feature stuff we think is great, and we build some trust with these people, with the fan side of the B2C essentially, then we could build that as another path of discovery. We could help artists out. And we could really feature certain ones, even though everyone can put their stuff up and use the tool. And we started doing that. And next thing you know, I mean, here we are 8 years later, and we've got, you know, 1.5 million people on that email list. And it grows. It's constantly growing. Every time someone downloads anything from Noisetrade, trades their data on Noisetrade, you know, they opt in for us too, and they can always opt out. But we try to do a really good job of bringing really cool features things they really want to know about. And we've really helped to break a few artists that way. So anyway, you know, so that has wound up becoming part of the business model. But again, it's adaptation. You know, it's like,
right,
it's like learning as you go. And so I don't think there was really a point where we were too resistant. What I can tell you we've been really resistant to is, you know, I have always said that the way I run this company is that I want us to be the In-N-Out Burger of free content distribution. Like, I would do not want us to get distracted. I want us to do one thing really well. Because there's a lot of things over the years we've thought, oh, we could do, and we could bolt onto it, we could do this and that. But that's why our recent deal with Pledge Music made so much sense to me. And the reason is because I have always felt like Noise Trade's real value. And we don't have debt, we've run it on revenue since the second or third year. I mean, you know, we run a good business, but we've never made a ton of money, but we've made enough to make it, you know, to run it and to keep it going. But we could make more. The point is, we could. There are ways we could make more money. And we do well with sponsorships and advertising things. But where our company's real value to me always was in the way that we generate customers for other platforms, because we cause really good problems for artists who do really well with us, because they do really well. They got a ton of data suddenly, this huge customer database. They have no idea what to do with it. They're petrified of it. They don't know how to extract value out of it, how to monetize it, how to analyze it or protect it. And we're not really in the business of solving those problems, of educating them on how to use the data to make money. But a platform like Pledge Music sure is.
Yeah.
And there are other platforms that are really good at that, at solving that problem. So I always imagined us being part of something bigger, where we could help drive customers, you know, and help those people, educate them with great products, and then stand in the stream of revenue that's created. And I don't think Noise Trade has to be the one who does that. And that's why I love this deal that we've gotten into with Pledge.
So this is an acquisition from Pledge Music.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yep. We announced it just about a month ago.
Oh, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks. And so, and it also, and that there's a third company in the little roll up, which is a company called Set FM, which is a Texas-based company, music startup that helps artists to capture live performance. It's one of the coolest pieces of technology you've ever seen. It allows you to record the show really simply, or as sophisticated as you want, to record your live shows and then sell them on the spot. So literally 30 seconds after the show is over, you can buy it at the merch table.
Wow.
And it's an incredible piece of technology. And it helps you to archive and monetize live performance, which, interestingly, generates a lot of great content for Noise Trade, because it doesn't poach artists' ability to sell the records that all those songs came from. Because
nice.
It neutralizes recorded master, because suddenly you've got all this exclusive live content you can then distribute. And it just, the three work together really well. So the three of us are now all partnered together.
That's excellent. Yeah. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks.
So Derek, this has been an absolute blast, but I want to wrap up on one final question.
Yes.
It's this idea I'm calling the entrepreneurial gap, which happens to artists as well. And at the very beginning, you alluded to it in this idea that we are always sort of putting our successes into the future. So when in 1 month when you get to do this, in 6 months when you get acquired, in 1 year when you get to sell that many records or make that revenue, you'll be successful.
True.
But right before you hit that, you set bigger, loftier goals into the future. And like walking towards the horizon, the further you walk, the further it gets away.
Yeah,
it's just
right.
The way it always is. And
that's right.
You've had this career since the early 90s where, like, literally where you had major labels at the beginning. Lots of people, when that stuff ends, not only does their career go downhill, but their life and everything.
Yeah.
And they just always want to be living in the past. But then you've created a brilliant solo career out of it. Now a brilliant business that has been acquired by Pledge Music.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a lot of successes. And I know that you want to keep looking into the future, where you can go and what you can do next. But I would love it right now, Derek, if you could stop and look behind you and the highs, the lows, the wins, the losses. But tell me how you feel about your whole journey up until today.
Wow. Well, that was generously summed up. Makes it sound like I've got some kind of a plan, which I don't and never have. But, you know, like so let me just say this. I obviously just feel like I have been mostly just incredibly fortunate, just really lucky. I had a friend once tell me that he thinks I'm really good at being lucky. And I think that's a pretty insightful observation. But, you know, I think I'm certainly very aware that, you know, most people don't even get half of the career that I have managed to cobble together over the last 20 something years, and let alone the opportunity to pivot and reinvent into a different career that, you know, the way that we've managed to with Noise Trade and things like that. And I mean, I mostly just feel really, really, really fortunate, and it makes me take it all incredibly seriously. And since the very beginning of my solo career, when I realized, wow, I'm in a really interesting position because I have this luxury of having come out of a band that did pretty well. So I got to kind of see and experience and feel some things that most artists spend their whole careers kind of trying to and wanting to feel and experience. I got to kind of do that. And I got to do it in a safe way because it wasn't just my career. It was a band. And now I get to kind of benefit from it, but also not have it haunt me to where that wasn't really my success. That was our success. And now I get to go into my own career and decide how I want that to feel and what I want to pursue, what my values are as an artist. And it just gave me this very luxurious position. And so my very first solo record was a very unlikely debut record. I mean, it was like, didn't get carried in a lot of retail because it had like content that was controversial on it and things like that. But I was like, this is what art should be doing. Like, and not every artist has to do it this way, but I feel like this is really important. I want to use this little platform to say some things that are important and engage issues that I think are important to me. And so I kind of took that very seriously. I feel the same way about my entrepreneurial career, that like, I feel like I've been given a real opportunity and not everyone does. And so I want to really work hard at it and make a lot of it and take it really seriously, because there's not a day that goes by that I don't wake up and feel so fortunate that I've been on the path that I have. And so mostly I feel really grateful. But I also mostly feel, I know that everybody, I've talked to so many friends of mine who are entrepreneurs and who are artists and who are, you know, I have this thing called imposter syndrome where, you know, they just feel like any day someone's going to find me out and someone's going to discover that I don't know what I'm doing and that I'm not qualified, like, you know, to do any of these things. Cause I mean, you know, I barely got out of high school. You know, I didn't even think about going to college. I was spent, you know, 10 years in a band. I'm the last person you would want running your tech company. And yet that's somehow I found myself into that role. And to me, so much of the time I feel like I'm not qualified. Like I'm not qualified to do this job. Like I'm underwater. If anyone knew how little I really know about what I'm doing, they would be terrified. But the thing is, the more really self-aware and vulnerable mentors that I've had, every one of them has told me the same. Every single one of them, like guys who run multi-million-dollar businesses, have told me, like, don't tell anybody, but I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't know how I got here. You know, like so much of arriving at certain places like this has to do with times, places, luck. You know, I mean, it's like what Malcolm Gladwell talks about. It's like an intersection of skill, but mostly just sheer opportunity and luck. And it's like anybody who thinks they deserve to be where they are in a story like this that's a path to destruction, you know, like, cause you don't. And so I don't really know what I'm doing. And so, which makes me all the more grateful, but you know, that's, as I squint my eyes at it, that's how it all feels to me, you know?
Nice. And that's a beautiful answer. It's not about like necessarily quote unquote deserving to be where you are.
Right.
Because you obviously do. And this whole idea of the fact that you're really good at being lucky, it's like luck really comes to people who kind of put themselves in the way of luck.
Right.
Your idea of the very beginning, you said the one thing is failure has led you to the most things. Most people aren't willing to put themselves in the way of potential failure.
Right.
And that's where luck comes from. Quote unquote luck.
Yeah. Because, I think that's just, it's so important. It's so important to get comfortable with failure and to learn how to turn it into opportunity, learn how to turn it into your education, which it definitely has been for me. And it makes you a more tolerable person to work with because you're keenly aware of exactly how you got here. I mean, you know, every path to any success I have is paved is paved on failure, you know, like,
exactly.
And I think even Steve Jobs, I mean, you know, a lot of people have said that, but like, you learn so much more from your, like, a failure you never forget. A success you don't remember for a minute. You know, most people don't even celebrate their successes. They just, yeah. they move on so fast. And I'm certainly that way. I miss my successes. I miss them.
Yeah.
You know, until someone generously sums them up in the way that you have, but it's like, that's not how it feels to me. That it feels like, you know, here are the things I learned, and yeah, and you learn the best things. And the things you learn that come from the insights you gain from failure more quickly become instinct, because it's like a survival technique. You're like, okay, that really didn't work last time, and I don't even have to write that down. I don't even have to make a mantra out of that. I'm never going to forget, because I never want to feel this way again. You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
It hurts. And, you know, so it's like a survival instinct. So it's a great way to learn. So
yeah. And that's why from the outside, we usually look and are successful. But from inside to ourselves, because we just jump past the successes so quick to bigger ones,
yeah,
it does feel that way. And that's why I think sometimes we live in this gap where we never, no matter what we accomplish, it's just we never feel successful. And from the outside,
that's right.
People are looking at us like, holy crap, Derek just can't stop. Like, everything's just hitting it out of the park. But to
oh my gosh.
You're just like, I just want one success.
Exactly. I'm like clawing and fighting and crawling, trying to like, exactly.
Oh, Derek, this has been an absolute blast. I thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, it's a pleasure. Yeah. Let's talk again.
So I'm sure you've intrigued a lot of the listeners. Could you now specifically tell the listeners where they can go find out more about you and your business?
Yes. So I'm pretty easy to find online. You can, anywhere you'd go looking, be it the internet or any social media platform. I'm just typically anything/Derek Webb, DerekWebb, DerekWebb.com, everything/Derek Webb. And then Noise Trade is just at noisetrade.com. And you can start there. And we've got some really cool things. Thanks to our, you know, our new partnership with Pledge Music, some really cool things. And I think we're just on the brink of really pivoting into a new season of providing really super useful tools for artists to meaningfully connect with their fans. I'm like, it's a lot of good work ahead this year. So if people want to pay attention, that's where they can find us.
Excellent. Excellent. So when you stop walking, working out, whatever it is you're doing right now, hacktheentrepreneur.com, you can find Derek's episode. I'll link to derekwebb.com, Derek Webb on Twitter and anywhere else I can find him, noisetrade.com, as well as his excellent conversation on The Gently Mad. I'll link to that. And then all this talk about Pledge Music has made me remember about my fun conversation I had with Benji Rogers, of Pledge Music, about a year ago. So I'll link to that so you can check that out as well.
Yeah.
And this 1,000 True Fans article, if you haven't read it,
you should read it literally like once a quarter. You should read that.
Exactly.
It's so good.
So I will link to that as well for everyone. So once again, Derek,
awesome.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. I know we had some audio troubles, but we sorted them out.
Yes.
And I appreciate your patience.
Yes.
But please just keep doing what you're doing, because it is awesome and inspiring to watch.
Man, well, thank you. It's great to talk to you, and we'll talk again.
All right, Derek, thank you very much. I think we did a pretty good job of patching that up and getting into the conversation the way we needed to. I really, really enjoyed speaking to Derek. I'm a sucker for, you know, the music business and Pledge Music. I didn't actually know at the beginning of the conversation, but Pledge Music is the one who just acquired Noise Trade, and Pledge Music was founded by Benji Rogers, who I interviewed quite a while, about a year ago now, on the show. Smart, smart, smart guy. And so it's cool to see the full circle of now they are working together. And Benji actually made the top 10, Hack the Entrepreneur top 10, which is coming out in 1 week. It's time. I think you're going to really enjoy it. It's a 10 episode series of the show, and it is the top 10 conversations I've had. So this conversation had some technical issues, but we got to some really, really good stuff. And I got to go back through it again and listen to it and just try and see where we went and exactly where we got to. And so I went back through it. And then I went back through it again. And then I went back through it one more time. The last time that I went through it, Derek said something that was so clear when he said it. It was right there. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
Because if we could give away a bunch of records, the people who downloaded it for free and hated it and deleted it, was a zero opportunity cost for us. We never would have gotten their money. So we're not giving anything up there. But the people who had not found it, over three records at that point in my career, had never found me, didn't know about me, had not taken a chance on me, who downloaded it, loved it. If you download the record and you love it, and I've got your information, I will get your money. Like, I will, you know what I'm saying? And that's not even a trick. It's like, because you can't wait to give it to me. Because if you really love and resonate with what I'm making, you're going to want to support it. Because I'm that way with artists who I love.
And that's the hack. Derek. I love this. I love this because of the music side of it and you giving away content. And this was it's still such a big thing in mainstream sort of music, the idea of giving away music. Bands like Radiohead have proven that you can give away music and make it so that you can just pay what you want and still make a ton of money and sell a ton of records. There's ways to do this and be smart, but I like this for the content marketing side of it. Right, I've said it over and over again, every business, every company, every artist nowadays is in the media business. Whether we like it or not, we need to create media of some sort. Whether that's a podcast, that's a blog, that's a book, that's YouTube channels, that's a song. You need to create things that you can give away to people. Because as Derek says, I love this, like if somebody downloads it for free because you created it, hates it, and deletes it, it's a zero opportunity cost. But if somebody downloads your podcast, somebody downloads your book, somebody watches your YouTube video, somebody reads your blog and loves it, when you get their contact information and you have them on an email list and they love your work, you will get their money. Because people love to support people that are doing good things. I love how we talk about Derek mentions, we talk about the 1,000 true fans. It's linked to it in the show notes. This is the basis of 1,000 Maniacs. This course that I've just recently created is because if you can get 1,000 people following my system of how I've done it with this podcast and with a blog and now pushed it into a best-selling book, is all based on having those people that love you based on free content. And then building that relationship by getting contact with them, taking that relationship deep, and then you will get their money. You absolutely will. And the people that don't like you, the people that hate you, the people that don't like your content, it doesn't matter. It doesn't cost you any extra to get it to them. It's the beauty of the leverage of the internet at this point. We get to create things and we can just, it can travel around the world. It can be distributed anywhere. Virtually for free. It's not for the people that hate us. They don't matter. It doesn't matter. They're not part of our tribe. They're not part of our group. They're not our true fans. They're not our maniacs. Create content. Create the media that you can create, that you feel is inside of you, and share it. Share it as far and as wide as you can. And get the contact information of the people that are into it. Thank you so very, very much, Derek. All right. That was an absolute blast. This has been a much longer episode than our typical running length, but yeah, I'd love to hear what you think. Sometimes I've been diving deeper and we've been going into these conversations to see where they kind of lead rather than the shorter form. And I know some of you like it and some of you don't. John@hacktheentrepreneur is my email address. Drop me a line. Tell me what you think or track me down on Twitter. I'd love to hear. You're the person I'm making this for. So I know I really enjoy the conversations and it'd be cool just to get your feedback. But that being said, I do not want to take any more of your time. It's been an absolute blast. Please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.